What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lankoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
Welcome in Legal Face Off on WGN, WGN Plus. Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside back in studio after a nice little break. It feels like summer. It's about 80 degrees outside in June in Chicago, and a handful of topics to get to today. There is a effort to bring El Chapo to the U.S., a lawsuit against McDonald's in the drive-thru area, more lawsuit abuse, and a handful of topics in the legal grab bag. But first, we bring up something very serious, and this is something that has caused some outrage, not only in California, but throughout the country. The sexual assault case at Stanford, where Brock Turner only getting 6 months. And for that and much more, we bring in Sharmilia Majumdar from the Rape Victim Advocates, the executive director. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So we've all, you know, by now heard the story, heard all the details. Three felony counts for raping this young woman who was unconscious, and the judge sentences this person, Brock Turner, to 6 months, and of which he'll serve maybe 3 months, is what our understanding. Why do you think the judge was so lenient in this case? Let's start there.
Well, he used the rationale that Brock Turner didn't have a record, that he was young, that he had a promising future. Presumably, he also used the character references that Brock Turner's father and other people provided as well. But I would have to say it's partially because he believed in victim blaming ideas that absolved Brock Turner of some of the responsibility of the three felonies that he was convicted with.
Yeah, Brock Turner's father, we've all read his statement, which, you know, is just impossible to read and not feel outrage, where he says that this was only 20 minutes. He laments the fact that he can know his son, you know, doesn't have an appetite, can't eat the ribeye steaks, in his words, that he used to cook for him. Is this kind of thing common in the cases that you see, that you deal with every day, shifting the focus to the victim in these kind of situations? Is this common to the cases that you deal with?
Absolutely. In fact, we often talk about the ways in which the criminal legal system process unfolds as a secondary victimization for many survivors. It can be the kind of barrage of questioning that the defense attorney presented that were incredibly intimate. It can be through the fact that we had such a light sentence in this case. And this was someone who was clear about what the impact was on her and her life. And we have someone here who was found guilty and is not clear about the impact of what his actions have had and has yet to display any kind of remorse or responsibility.
And there was a mention that with the three or four felony counts that were against him, he could have served a maximum of 14 years, which it sounds like a big discrepancy, 6 months to 14 years. Was there any guidance at all that Judge Persky gave as to why he chose 6 months?
So it's interesting because the minimum was supposed to be 2 years. Prosecutors asked for 6 years. But my understanding is that there was some judicial discretion built into how the sentencing could play out, and that if there were kind of extraordinary measures that would mitigate it, that he could take that into account and then give the sentence of 6 months, of which he is likely to only really actually serve 3 months.
Yeah, and you'd think that the egregious nature of this, I mean, he did this out in public where people, I mean, two grad students happened to bike by and see what was going on and pulled him off of her. You think that would add on to the sentence as opposed to whatever connection there is, you know, between the judge and this kid taken away from that sentence.
Yeah, and it seems like the judge basically said, well, he was drinking, so he didn't know what he was doing. I mean, to put it in its simplest terms. I think that it's one thing for Brock Turner's father to not hold him accountable. I do think that that's egregious and problematic. It's like, yes, I empathize. It's your child. You want to protect your child. But to basically say that he's not accountable at all for anything other than drinking, I think is really problematic. But then to have the judge, after a jury has unanimously found Brock Turner guilty of three felony counts, to then also essentially, I think in many ways, undermine the jury's verdict by having such a light sentence.
And what's really damaging, as you mentioned, is this correlation that the judge uses, that Brock Turner himself used, that the father used, this correlation between drinking and, you know, violating a young woman behind a dumpster on a college campus. Somehow that, you know, you could excuse that kind of behavior because you're drinking. I mean, what kind of takeaway, what kind of message does that send to society, to young women, to young men, that it's okay somehow that you're going to get a reduced sentence because both parties were drinking? I mean, the young woman in her, you know, in her address to the defendant, you know, said, yes, I was drinking. I admit that. But that doesn't obviously excuse this kind of behavior. What kind of message does this send to, you know, other victims of this kind of abuse and, you know, potential victims?
I think that's one of our biggest concerns, right? Because we still, sexual assault is one of the most underreported crimes already. It is particularly underreported on college campuses. So you take that, you factor that in, and then you see what happened with this case. And, you know, a lot of survivors will be like, why would I come forward? You know, what do I get out of putting myself through this process, which has unfolded over a year? So this is not, you know, we often talk about the Law and Order and CSI effect. Everyone expects everything to get wrapped up in an hour. But these are long cases. And she has had over a year of really trauma happening again and again through how drawn out this has been.
Sharmilee Majumdar is with us in studio, Legal Face-Off on WGN+. Brock Turner, an athlete, swam at Stanford. And I don't have to tell you that athletes sometimes get away with way more than they should. Why is that? Why do athletes seem to get more benefit of the doubt than maybe the average American?
There was actually a recent study that suggested that college athletes are slightly more likely to commit sexual violence than other college students. And I think the theory behind that is basically that there's a way in which their social status is elevated, and there's a way in which their behavior is excused as it is associated with that social status. And you know, we've seen that play out across college campuses, across the country. Unfortunately for advocates like us, while this is a particularly egregious case, it is not a unique case. And we do see it frequently that survivors are met with disbelief and blame when they come forward about sexual violence, and that's part of why we exist.
As a plaintiff's attorney, I've actually represented two sexual assault victims, and they were, you know, to see what they go through, I mean, you know, we question them as my client on a direct exam, and then, you know, the cross exam gets pretty rough and they're crying, and it's a big ordeal to relive all that. I can't imagine what's going through this victim's mind when she, you know, completes all that process after a year. She gets on the stand, testifies, and then a sentence like this is handed down. I mean, it's got to be a blow.
I think the hopeful pieces of the story are that there has been so much outrage, so there is a sense that there is a swelling of support for this survivor. And I don't think Brock Turner is going to be able to necessarily escape that kind of public scrutiny and public criticism. And I think the other thing, too, is, you know, we see that bystander intervention works. You know, these two students could have kind of continued biking on and ignoring what they saw. And instead, to their credit, they interrupted. And one of the students who interrupted was so affected by what he saw that he was weeping at the point that he was telling police about what he witnessed.
Yeah, I mean, they're real heroes in this story. In addition, obviously, to the victim to come out this forcefully and, you know, share that address with the world. I mean, to Jason's point, when she was addressing Brock Turner, she was explaining some of the questions that she was asked during trial. I mean, very difficult cross-examination. Now, listen, on this show, we cover both sides of every issue, and we understand that every attorney's got a job to do. But in this case, some of the questions she were asked were things like, did you drink in college? You said you were a party animal. How many times did you black out? These are all questions that she had to face. Did you party at frats? Are you serious with your boyfriend? Are you sexually active with him? Are these examples of, you know, attacking the victim of sexual abuse cases? And how difficult is that for the victims?
Absolutely. I just recently saw something on Twitter in response to this where basically said that there's this pattern of how the women who come forward about sexual violence are seen as having a past. Like, what did you do? How did you deserve this? It's something, a flaw in your character. Whereas the men who are accused, and very often it's men, are seen as having potential. And what's the lost potential by holding them accountable for their actions? And I think overall, what we experience is that from the point at which a victim reports the sexual assault through to the adjudication process, if they go through the criminal legal system, the scrutiny is on them. And our message is that we should be doing offender-focused investigation, and we should be investigating the crime, not the victim.
You know, we've talked on this show. We've had Gloria Allred on. We've talked on this show about the Bill Cosby victims and how they span decades. And most of those cases are not ever going to go to court. They're never going to see the light of day because the statute of limitations has been, you know, a long time since passed. Is your group, I know there's a movement right now to try and at least eliminate the statute of limitations or make it so that it's, you know, expanded a little bit more. Are you guys involved in that at all?
We're members of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault, which is leading an effort to eliminate the statute of limitations in Illinois.
Tell us where we are in Illinois with regards to sexual assault on campus, and why does a college campus, why is that such a breeding ground for sexual predators? You know, there's a movie that came out, I'm sure you're aware of it, The Hunting Ground, very powerful film about, you know, this epidemic of sexual abuse on college campuses. Why is that, and where are we currently in Illinois with legislation on that issue?
So the Preventing Sexual Violence in Higher Education Act was passed and has gone into effect, which basically kind of crystallizes what the requirements are for higher education institutions in Illinois to comply not only with that law, but with Title IX and a number of other kind of compliance issues. And really what it is saying is to these institutions, you have a responsibility to create a safe learning environment and an equitable learning environment. And these are the things you need to do to make that happen. So we're providing a lot of training, technical assistance, and consultation around that to higher education institutions across the area. In terms of why colleges are such a focus and why it seems like there's so much sexual violence happening on campus, I think part of it is that very often students are isolated from their sources of support. And isolation is a factor in vulnerability. And we know that people who commit sexual violence seek vulnerability. That's how they target who they are going to assault. And in a lot of ways, colleges are set up, especially in the first few years, to create that kind of isolation as well. There are absolutely factors like alcohol and alcohol use and alcohol abuse. But we know plenty of people who get assaulted and who assault when they're sober. So alcohol can't be the only thing that we focus on when we talk about sexual violence. In addition to all of that, it's not always clear to students what resources are available to them, who they can report to, and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And they may not feel like their learning environment is supportive of them as a survivor. And they know the person very often who's assaulted them, which creates yet another barrier to really coming forward. They can feel like they're going to be ostracized, that they're going to be blamed. It might be someone of social status. We were talking about athletes before. And feeling like coming forward is just opening the door to a barrage of scrutiny, online violence, accusations, threats, etc.
Sharmila, you've been dealing with this stuff for about 20 years. You've been with the Rape Victim Advocates since 2008. How do people get involved, and why should they get involved?
So people can go to our website. It's www.rapevictimadvocates.org. And if someone is in need of services at any point, they can call the 24-hour crisis line in the city of Chicago, which is 888-293-2080. There are lots of ways to get involved. We have tons of volunteer opportunities. In fact, we provide 24-hour crisis response at 14 hospitals in the Chicago area, and we do that mostly with highly trained volunteers who are incredible. But we also have ongoing programming on all sorts of things like men getting involved in ending gender-based violence. We have a discussion series called Men in the Movement. We also have opportunities for people who are interested in joining our board of directors or joining by fundraising and supporting the work that we do that way as well, as well as spreading the word. You know, we'll come out to your school, we'll come out to your house of worship or any organization, civic organization that you might have, and talk to folks about sexual violence. We can talk to parents and teachers about how to talk about sexual abuse with children, which we think is pretty important. But we have a pretty comprehensive menu of services, and there are lots of different entry points for people. I think what I'd want people to walk away with, though, is to understand that this is not a problem that's over in California or in just in this particular Santa Clara district. This is a problem that is across the U.S. and certainly here in Chicago, and we really all need to be a part of that solution. And part of that is as simple as saying to victims of sexual violence, either individually or, you know, on social media, that we believe you, that it's not your fault, and that there are resources available.
Extremely tough stuff to talk about. Thank you for helping us paint a picture. Charmelle Majbadar with us on Legal Face Off. Thanks for coming in studio.
Thanks for having me.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Be sure to listen to Legal Face Off on iTunes. Search for Legal Face Off. Also on Facebook and Twitter as well. If you want to listen on the go, past, present, or future, as we welcome to Legal Face Off Travis Aiken, who's the executive director of the organization Illinois Lawsuit Abuse Watch. There's a drive-through lawsuit against McDonald's and some lawsuit abuse we'll get into. But first, we welcome Travis to Legal Face Off. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Travis. Thanks for joining us on Legal Face Off. So, you and I feel the same way about many lawsuits in Illinois. I am a defense lawyer. I defend a lot of what I consider frivolous lawsuits. My co-host, Jason Whiteside, will disagree, of course, and that's fine. What we want to ask you about today is a couple of things. First of all, Sam referenced the McDonald's drive-through lawsuit that was filed recently in Chicago's federal court. Would you tell us about that lawsuit?
Yeah, so you have a situation in New Orleans where a fellow has sued McDonald's. He's a blind individual, and his claim is that the drive-through window at McDonald's, which basically at night, the only way to get food at some locations is to actually go through the drive-through, and they don't serve pedestrians, you know, people who are walk-up customers. You have to be in a car. And so the lawsuit here involves a blind individual who claims that McDonald's is discriminating against blind people by requiring only motored customers to come through the drive-through when he can't drive. He has to either get a taxi or he has to have a friend transport him to the restaurant, and so he's filing an ADA lawsuit that under the ADA statutes, and they're trying to get class action status. And so this case, the attorney in this case happens to be a law firm in New Orleans. The plaintiff involved is from New Orleans, but the suit has been filed in Cook County. And what I'm arguing is that there is a reason why this suit is being filed in Cook County, even though it's a federal lawsuit in federal court, is because we are seeing an uptick in a lot of ADA claims. And what I argue is kind of what's been happening in California has kind of made its way to Chicagoland, and so I think that this what my position is that this attorney is trying to capitalize on that wave.
And Travis, to that point, speaking about ADA, this plaintiff's name McGee. His name is Scott McGee, the blind Louisiana plaintiff in this case. His brother is named Emmett. He's also represented by the attorney in New Orleans, Castellas. And his brother is also suing a company alleging an ADA violation. This time he's suing Coca-Cola, alleging that the soda machines, the freestyle soda machines that allow you to mix their own cocktails of soda flavors using a touchscreen, that those violate the ADA because blind customers cannot use them without assistance. Isn't that true?
I'm not familiar with the Coca-Cola lawsuit, but...
That's a lawsuit filed by his brother. So, I mean, do you think that the ADA was meant to be used in this way, people suing McDonald's for not being able to walk up to a drive-through window?
No, I don't think so. And for me, obviously, I think businesses need to have reasonable standards, reasonable access, and to what extent they are in violation of ADA standards, they should they take steps to correct it. What I take issue with is, does a lawsuit have to be the initial vehicle in order to make these changes? And you look at, for instance, I've been studying the ADA lawsuit situation in Illinois, and from what I've seen in media reports, last year, of the 94 ADA lawsuits filed in the North District Court of Illinois, 77 of them involved 8 plaintiffs represented by the same lawyers. And, you know, that tells me that what's really going on here is people are looking for ways to file these lawsuits. And it's not really about trying to correct the wrong so much as it is finding a way to sue. And that's certainly what happened in California. They had 40% of the nation's ADA lawsuits filed in the state of California. And the legislature there, in a bipartisan bill that was signed into law here just recently this year by Governor Jerry Brown, put some protections for businesses to at least give them some time to address these concerns when they're notified that they may not be ADA compliant. And so I think here in Illinois, this is the direction we're going. We're going to see a lot more of these cases. California has taken some steps to try to address their ADA lawsuit climate. I think here in Illinois, we need to look at what happened in California and recognize, you know, we need to do something here before this situation gets out of control.
Hey, Travis, it's Jason here. You know, I agree, even as a plaintiff's attorney, sometimes there are lawsuits that do seem frivolous. You know, in this McDonald's instance, though, I mean, the interior of the McDonald's is ADA compliant. Is there any solution that they have proposed, either McDonald's or the plaintiff's attorney, for the exterior, such as installing some sort of phone? I think there was an article about that. Or some other way for a blind individual or another handicapped individual to order McDonald's. I mean, that seems like a simple solution, and I don't know why it hasn't been done.
And I agree with you. I mean, I don't know exactly why McDonald's has these policies, other than I think it probably has something to do with the safety of the workers, that, you know, having someone come up, not necessarily being able, you know, late at night, not being able to see, is this person armed? Are we going to be putting our employees in a harmful situation? I think there ought to be some sort of acknowledgement that, you know, people may not have access to vehicles because of disabilities or because they just don't own a car. But they would, I think McDonald's in their interest to sell hamburgers wants to make that sale. But can we find some solution that, you know, protects the safety of the workers who are there late at night at times of night when a lot of crime happens? Can we protect the workers but also serve the needs of the most customers? Because, you know, they're in the business of selling hamburgers. I mean, I think they would want to make that sale and want to find a way to get that business.
We're joined by Illinois Lawsuit Abuse Watch Executive Director Travis Aiken. His website is IL lawsuitabusewatch.org. Travis, let's turn to tort reform. We have a history in Illinois of some tort reform legislation overturning or being overturned by the Supreme Court, most recently in 2005. What's the current state of tort reform in our state, especially given the budget crisis that we're in and the fact that we've got a Republican governor, Rauner, who's fighting a Democratic-controlled legislature led by Mike Madigan, and one of Rauner's key goals was tort reform. What's the current state? Do you think anything will be passed, given everything that's going on in Springfield?
Well, I can tell you that we have, as an organization, had several opportunities to meet with the governor over the course of this last legislative session, which is, I guess, technically still ongoing because they didn't pass a budget. But we have had a number of opportunities to talk to the governor, and the message that we've given him is, look, we understand the situation you're in. We understand the difficulties of getting these things passed, but you told us early on that lawsuit reform was part of your agenda. We want to know, is it still on the table? And the governor has given us assurances that he still wants these reforms. He's still fighting for these reforms. Now, last spring, there was actual legislation introduced to represent some of the lawsuit reform bills that the governor wanted. This year, the strategy was to try to pin down a budget agreement and then work with the Democrats in the House and the Senate to try to get some sort of agreement on different reforms. So rather than introduce specific legislation, all of the conversations revolving all the different reforms the governor has proposed, whether it's property tax reform or term limits, et cetera, has all taken place within the context of the budget negotiations. So there was no actual specific bill introduced in this legislative session. So what I have been doing is basically telling people and taking that message that the governor is still fighting for these reforms and trying to build support in the legislature by having our members and our organization get in contact with different legislators and get this message out there that they need to support these reforms. So that's kind of where we are. I mean, we still don't have a budget. We still don't know what parts of Rauner's agenda will be part of any kind of long-term budget solution, if any at all. But as an organization, we're going to keep fighting for these reforms.
Reading on the website, Travis, Illinois is ranked 48th out of all 50 states in the country for legal fairness. That's the stat found on IL lawsuitabusewatch.com.
Sounds very, very, like a very, very substantial stat.
Thanks, yeah, Sam. 48th out of 50. So Travis Aiken is the executive director. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Welcome back, Legal Face-Off on WGN and WGN Plus here on the 7th floor of the Tribune Tower. And there's a lot to talk about in our next segment here, which is about bringing El Chapo to the United States. We've got some experts on extradition. We've got some experts on U.S.-Mexico law. So we'll bring in our guest right here on the phone. Ignacio Pinto León is the director of Eurus-MexCorp, and he's also an adjunct professor at the University of Law Center. He's a dual U.S.-Mexico licensed attorney. And also David Weinstein, who is a partner at Clark Silvergate, Attorneys at Law, and he's also had a lot of experience with extraditions as well. So we welcome both of you. Thank you for your time, and welcome to WGN.
Thank you guys for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So, David, you are a former federal prosecutor. You oversaw the narcotics division at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Miami. How big of a get, first of all, is El Chapo?
He's a rather large grab for the Department of Justice. He's one of many, primarily because he has so many cases in so many different jurisdictions. There are other traffickers who have been as large in the past, but none who have spread their tentacles throughout the United States.
Ignacio, tell us what the current state of the bringing El Chapo to the U.S. Where are we currently in that process?
Last month was a very busy month on this case. May the 9th, a federal judge conceded the extradition of Mr. Guzman, two extradition requests from the United States, actually. On the same month, the 20th of May, the Foreign Ministry approved the extradition. Mr. Guzman was notified of that decision the same day. And by the end of May the 25th, Mr. Guzman's lawyers filed an unparalleled lawsuit trying to avoid the extradition. So right now, this case is under consideration of a federal judge in Mexico City, and that is where we stand up, where we stand now.
How common is it for Mexico to agree to an extradition of such a high-level criminal or narcotics trafficker?
For what I've seen, Mexico's position has varied during times, and Mr. Weinstein could be a witness to this. In previous year, probably before 2000, Mexico had some years resisted extradition. That all changed. That's at least my impression. Under the new, when we have a new ruling party in power in 2000, Mexico was more open to concede extraditions, and extraditions were very common from 2000 to 2012. When the old ruling party, the PRI, came back in 2012, it seems like a stoppage in this influx of extradition from Mexico to the United States, but now it is very clear that at least in this particular case, Mexico is very interested in moving ahead with the extradition of Joaquin El Chapo Guzman.
All right. And David, take us through what the process is on the American side as a former prosecutor as to how America decides or the Attorney General decides which city is going to get the extradition of Chapo and prosecute him.
Well, because there are so many different competing indictments that have been filed against Guzman here in the United States, the Attorney General sort of stands as a gatekeeper and tries to mediate between the different jurisdictions. She's doing that by evaluating the strength of each case in each jurisdiction, the witnesses who are both available to testify, as well as the amount of evidence that's going to be introduced against him. Mexican law precludes the imposition of the death penalty, so the indictments that are currently lodged against Guzman that are seeking the imposition of the death penalty are not going to be considered as places where he would be extradited. Last but not least, they have to consider jurisdictional and venue questions. There are certain offenses that are charged that require a defendant to, for the first time, set foot into that jurisdiction in order for that particular jurisdiction to try him for that charges. That deals with a charge that's called the 959 charge, which is a conspiracy outside the U.S. to manufacture or distribute drugs into the U.S. So all of that comes into play. And then the parties at the table decide where he's going to come first.
So given how successful El Chapo has been in busting out of custody a couple of times that we're aware of, walk us through, David, the process of securing him from the point of departing Mexico until the point he's in U.S. custody. Who leads that? Is that a Mexican endeavor? Is it a joint endeavor between U.S. and Mexican authorities? And how does that look different from other extraditions, given how dangerous El Chapo is?
It'll be both common to the other extradition practices and quite a bit more secure. The handoff process itself is handled by whichever country, in this case, has current custody of the defendant. So they'll be responsible for making the handoff. The Department of Justice will work in conjunction with both the U.S. Marshals as well as DEA in order to secure a flight for Guzman from Mexico to whatever jurisdiction he's going to need to touch down in first. It's not going to be quite as clandestine as Kiefer Sutherland might make it on 24, but the people who were involved are going to receive their orders at virtually the last minute on a need-to-know basis, and it'll be a very quick process, the pickup and then the drop-off here in the U.S.
Can one of you explain to our listeners the difference in these situations between deportation and extradition?
Sure. Deportation occurs when an individual is unlawfully present in a particular country without permission of that country. That person may or may not have committed a crime in that country. And if the country decides that they're no longer desirable to be in that country, they go through what's called deportation proceedings. Extradition proceedings are actual proceedings that take place where a particular defendant has been arrested pursuant to the request of another nation based on charges that have been filed, and then the requesting nation has to file certain documents under oath that set out what the crimes are, what the penalties are, what the supporting evidence is. Depending upon what country you're being extradited from, some require first-person affidavits as well as sworn testimony from certain critical individuals.
Right. And Ignacio, on the appeal side with El Chapo, how much longer can that take? I mean, we've seen instances where it's been years before the appeals process is exhausted for El Chapo on the Mexican side. How much longer do you think El Chapo has before this extradition can actually take place?
It could take more than 1 year, actually. And technically, what El Chapo attorneys are doing right now is going with the federal judge and claiming that the extradition order violates Mr. Guzman's constitutional rights. So this is technically a trial of constitutionality. And this particular type of cases is decided by one judge, and there is one review process available after the decision becomes, after the judge rules on the case, and that decision can be reviewed by a three-judge panel. So we're talking probably about six to nine months for the first judge to rule, and probably 5 to 8 months for the three-judge panel to rule. And even then, there could still be a small window for their attorneys to try to take the case to the Supreme Court for a last review. And, of course, Supreme Court will have to decide to take up the case. It's not automatic review, but we could be talking about at least a year.
Ignacio, you're an expert in Mexican law. Give us some insight into sort of what the psyche is of the Mexican judicial system when the U.S., you know, comes in and says, we want to remove someone who's in your judicial system and, you know, physically bring them to our country to face justice. Is that something that, you know, Mexico pushes back, pushes back a little bit? Do they feel like, hey, this is, you know, someone that we're prosecuting and back off? Is there any of that sort of back and forth that goes into it?
I can see this at two levels. First, extradition is an international cooperation tool that goes both ways. Mexico receives extradited individuals from the U.S. and other countries, and Mexico extradites individuals to other countries as well. So I would think that the starting point is that this is an international cooperation mechanism and not necessarily an issue where sovereignty or similar concepts come into play. At a very practical level, too, and I can see when El Chapo was recaptured at the beginning of this administration of President Peña Nieto, it seemed like the government was resisting the extradition. They were giving an argument saying that he committed crimes in Mexico. He has to be tried in Mexico first. And this came from the Ministry of the Interior, which is probably one of the most powerful ministries in Mexico. But then El Chapo escaped again. And once they recaptured him, the same minister was openly sending the messaging that they were going to cooperate with the United States with the extradition request. So I, at least from my standpoint, is from my point of view, is that there is reality imposed themselves. So Mexico was not very effective in keeping Mr. Guzman after recapturing in 2012, and it as a practical matter, it's better off. Mexico is better off having El Chapo safely secured in a different country if Mexico itself is not able to provide that assurance.
All right, thank you. Last question, David. Once El Chapo gets to the U.S., is he finally going to be able to sit down with Del Castillo and write this amazing movie script and book deal that they've been working on?
She may hope that he is, but I think it's very unlikely. In order to get in to see an individual who's housed in a detention center, you either have to be that individual's attorney working for the government or a blood relative. So I think that it's unlikely that they're going to allow her in to see him while he's being detained pretrial. Perhaps after he's convicted, she might be able to convince the warden of whatever penitentiary he's placed in to allow a media visit. But I don't think that that memoir is going to be written anytime soon.
David Weinstein, a partner at Clark Silvergate, and Ignacio Pinto Leon, director of Eurismex Corp. and an adjunct professor at the University of Houston Law Center. Thank you both for your time and your expertise, and hopefully we'll talk to you down the road.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you.
Legal grab bag time, legal face-off. We round it out the same way every single show with Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside. And we've got seven topics today. Will we get to them all? We will see.
We must.
How we start.
We must.
Well, we'll go first to the estate of Muhammad Ali, who leaves behind a great legacy. Four marriages, nine kids that we know about, a lot of bankruptcy skirmishes, and complicating health that declined over about 30 years. So lots of money, and I think you guys should help lead it off on where we start dividing this money, who gets what, how much is actually available. Who wants to take the lead here?
Well, we're hearing that there's an $80 million estate, right? You pegged it with the different marriages, four different marriages, many children, one of which I guess is in Chicago.
It doesn't sound like he's doing real well.
No, it sounds like Junior, as his name is destitute. So he'll be looking for some money. But, Muhammad Ali sold a controlling share of the GOAT company, greatest of all time, over the years, and that was sold ultimately in 2011 for $512 million. Muhammad Ali got, it looks like, $50 million at the time in 2006. So,
yeah,
lots of money.
It was a complicated sale, too. There were portions that were CXX-owned that were then sold off, and so I think, Muhammad Ali ended up with about $50 million with it. But he's on his fourth wife now, and as you know, she's going to obviously have a conflict with the children that are not related to her by blood. So this will be interesting, just like we've covered Robin Williams and Ernie
Prince
Banks.
And
the list goes on and on.
Well, in a lot of these cases, the likeness, the image, the intellectual property of these people is worth as much or sometimes more in death than it is in life. I mean, Michael Jackson is the prime
over
example.
$1 billion since he died.
So lots of fighting to come over Muhammad Ali's $80 million fortune.
There is a gorilla that lost its life a while back. Harambe, H-A-R-A-M-B-E. Am I saying that right? Is it Harambe that died at the Cincinnati Zoo?
Let's go to our animal expert, Rich Lankoff.
Rich Lankoff is our linguist.
It's Haramba, I think, is the proper name. I don't know.
He was 450
pounds. We have a long
pounds.
Tradition on the show of bungling live
names.
People's names. Why not extend it to gorillas?
And the mother of the three-year-old
deceased
boy
gorillas,
who fell into the gorilla exhibit at the Cincinnati Zoo will not face charges.
So criminally, the prosecutor announced yesterday that they're not going to prosecute the family, specifically the mother, for criminal negligence for allowing the child to fall into the gorilla pit. So that seems to be done. The question now is whether there's some exposure civilly for the zoo. There certainly is exposure. The question is whether the family will sue. They've come out and said in the wake of this in the last week or so how grateful they are that the zoo spared their kid's life and shot the gorilla, unfortunately. And they've said they won't pursue any action. Who knows? As lawyers like Jason get a hold of them, then I'm sure there'll be some pressure to file a lawsuit. The question is whether a lawsuit alleging that the zoo was negligent in allowing the kid to, you know, get into the pit would be successful. I obviously think it's ridiculous, but there's some exposure there for sure.
Yeah,
would
I mean,
you take
I think
that? Would, the you, only, would you sue the zoo?
Well, I think the only traction that the case has is there's a long history of the zoos removing. They used to have safety net up, so they removed it so that everyone could feel closer to the animals now, and so there's not the big, you know, partition between the animals and individuals, but. There's also a thing called contributory negligence, which, you know, the mother having a three-year-old child will be held accountable for some sort of negligence for not keeping him in check and allowing him to climb over this partition and fall 15 feet into the gorilla.
On the other hand, though, I mean, you know, not to take the plaintiff's perspective, but the zoo is on notice that people, kids come to the zoo, that parents aren't necessarily watching their kid every minute. So they're on notice that this might happen. So, yes, obviously the zoo, and if I was defending the zoo, I would argue that the, you know, mother was contributory negligent. But, you know, the bigger picture is it's really a notice case, right? How much notice did the zoo have? Is it reasonable? Was the fence that they had a reasonable? Did they meet their duty of care? Was that reasonable? And a lot of this goes to a lot, you know, a lot of the decision would be whether this has happened in the past. And now, I mean, going forward, I think every zoo in the country is on notice that a 3-foot wall is probably not enough to meet your burden.
I mean, how tall is a 3-year-old? I don't even know. I mean, they're less than 3 feet tall.
Yes.
So, I mean, this kid obviously had to climb pretty well. But it does give notice to every zoo that whatever enclosure the Cincinnati Zoo had is obviously not enough to stop a child from climbing up it and over it.
And watch your kids, basically.
And yeah, get those little like backpacks with leashes.
The leash.
Sam was a product.
Sam
had one of those up until what, like 3 years ago?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Sam, they don't
buzz. One of those helmets, too.
Do what you got to do. Mind buzz.
Sam was a very special young man.
Any civil ramifications? Can this go to a civil court?
Well, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a potential civil lawsuit where, you know, the parents, I mean, the only litigants would be really the parents against the zoo. Zoos are, you know, sued all the time for injuries that happen on their premises, like any other business owner. Again, the question here would be whether it would survive a motion for summary judgment, whether it would get to a jury. I think practically, I mean, there's no way that given the notoriety of this event and given how much, you know, flack the parents have received or the mother has received online, I think it's unlikely that she would pursue it. But again, she has, you know, a couple of years to decide. And it's not, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, almost 2 years from now, we see a lawsuit.
I mean,
although, but the question, by the way, what are the damages, right? I mean, the damages to the kid.
There aren't, I mean, there's,
I mean, psychological trauma, nonsense like that.
No, he had a concussion, no broken bones. I mean, it's just not a high value. Ohio has caps anyway. So, you know, I don't know. It's not a great case, but there is the political pressure right now, especially in the news media, that, you know, if someone were to take the case, strike now and get a quick settlement.
And just one more quick thing, just interesting legal, you know, point a lot of people have raised this is whether the, if this did go to a jury, whether the plaintiff, in this case the parents, would argue that, well, look, isn't it proof that they were negligent because they put up this higher fence? Doesn't that prove that they were negligent? And that gets into an issue that we deal with all the time called post-remedial measures, which we don't want to get too technical, but the law says basically that you can't argue that just because a defendant, just because the zoo in this case fixed the problem, that's proof that they're negligent. Otherwise, no one would fix problems. Otherwise, we'd have no seatbelts and things like that. So,
yeah.
Let's talk Trump. Why don't we? About 10 days ago, and this is after our last show, kind of sandwiched in the middle here, Trump was ripping into a federal judge, Gonzalo Curiel. Curiel is presiding over the class action lawsuits against Trump University and against Trump. So Trump is campaigning in San Diego, goes on a 12-minute rant in his speech to rail against the judge. He then calls him Mexican. The judge was born in Indiana. And some people are now saying that Trump has somehow hit an even newer low.
It's pretty unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, you know, from a legal perspective, I mean, listen, there's been a million people talking about this. So, you know, we'll cover the legal angle of it. I mean, you know, Jason and I appear before judges, state, federal, all sorts of levels every day. And, you know, I know we would never dream of speaking out publicly against a judge. I mean, it's just not done. I mean, listen.
And even though you can take a change of a judge, they all talk. I mean, they all talk behind closed doors. So if, you know, we say something derogatory about a judge, it's going to get around to every judge, not just in Cook County, but every other venue that we practice in, especially on a national stage like this.
Yeah, I mean, the merit of, you know, his argument is not even worth wasting our time on. I mean, obviously, you know, even if, let's even assume, I mean, the argument that this judge was born in Indiana is not even the point. I mean, let's say this judge was born in Mexico. Let's say he's been in this country for a year. Who cares? That's assuming that a judge who's born in Mexico can't put aside the fact that he's Mexican to rule on the merits. So, I mean, it doesn't matter where this judge was born. But from a legal perspective, yeah, I mean, you know, in the middle of litigation to come out and attack the judge is ridiculous. I mean, there is a basis. You know, if Trump feels like the judge is not being fair, file a motion. That's what motions are for, to recuse the judge and
get a new judge in there. But
so it's ridiculous. But yeah, it does seem like a new low for Trump.
U.S.
But don't sue us, Trump.
Well, the new thing that came out today was there was a conference call with Trump, and he says he was presented this memorandum from his own campaign, and they said, "Hey, one of your campaign managers is telling everyone to tone down the rhetoric against the Hispanic judge." He said,
"Throw it
that
out
guy's
of here.
Stupid.
Get him out of here.
Whoever wrote that's an idiot and doesn't know what they're talking about." He wants them to double down now on their bashing the Hispanic judge. So.
Get him out.
And somehow his ratings just keep going up. Doesn't matter what he does.
Right.
They just keep going up. The U.S. women's national soccer team was in Chicago recently. They were talking about a wage claim that they were paid only a fourth of what the men's players were paid. They tried to strike, but that was denied by a federal judge. So what's next for the U.S. women's soccer team?
Well, I think the issue's over. They filed a suit in federal court here in Chicago before Judge Sharon Johnson Coleman, who's a great judge, and they were alleging that the U.S. Soccer Federation, basically they were alleging that they were paid less wages than their male counterparts.
Yeah, fourth only, that they only made a quarter of what the men make.
Right, so Judge Coleman ruled in favor of the U.S. Soccer Federation. And this, again, sort of like it reminded me of the Tom Brady Deflategate case. This case wasn't really about whether the U.S. women's soccer team should be paid more or less than men. This was really basically a contract case. Just like the Deflategate is not really about the merits of whether he deflated the ball or not. That was a contract case. That was about whether Goodell had the ability to enforce this rule under the collective bargaining agreement. Exact same situation here. Judge Coleman said that under the collective bargaining agreement that the women's team signed, that governed the wages. And that was it. And that was just a narrow ruling about whether this contract should be enforced.
Yeah, and they agreed to a different pay scale and structure than the men's team did. And so that's the decision kind of pointed out that you're bound by it now. And whether it's good, when it's good for you. When it's bad for you. So you just have to deal with it.
Right.
Kardashian and West making some news. Kim and Kanye are going to threaten their bodyguard, who they fired. He was going to try and make a satire sort of bit out of what he learned and what he found out. $30 million, the lawsuit from Kim and Kanye against their former bodyguard.
Yeah, Steve Stanulius is out there blabbing to everyone all about Kim and Kanye's life when he was their former bodyguard. So their attorney for the Kardashians has issued a letter to him to shut his mouth and stop doing interviews. But there's a clause in his confidentiality agreement that if he mentions anything about the Kardashians and Kanye West, then he's on the hook for $10 million. They can point to three interviews that they said he has spoken about them. Just speaking about them, the Kanye West and Kim Kardashian ignites the clause and triggers the payment. So they're asking him to just issue an apology and shut his mouth, and they won't seek any more damages.
Yeah, Stanulis said it was easier to deal with North, the baby, than it was dealing with Kanye.
Surprise, surprise. Yes.
I think they're on the same level. Right?
Yes.
We move from one rapper to another, and we've got another one on the back end. Lil Jon with something involving intellectual property. What
Hang
did
on,
Lil
is it,
Jon
You mean
do?
Lil
Jon.
Yes.
Little Jon?
Not Little.
Not Stephen Little either. Lil Jon. My apologies.
Yeah, Lil Jon has asked a...
You said Little too.
I said Lil.
You added a T.
I said
you're,
Lil Jon.
You're the whitest people alive.
Our resident gangster rapper over here, Rich Lenkov. Well, anyway, the story is that Lil Jon, who came up with the song Turn Down for What? Am I saying that right?
Turn down for what?
All right. He asked a East Hampton store called Blue and Cream. It sounds like a store Rich
Lenkov. Easy.
To stop putting turned down for what on flasks they were selling, unless they make a licensing agreement with them for 40% of future profits. So the Blue and Cream owner said they would rather just stop selling the flasks altogether.
But it shows, I mean, it is amazing that, like, you know, an artist as big as Lil Jon is aware of what one store, albeit a pretty well-known store in the Hamptons, is doing. I mean, you walk down the street of Chicago, you'll see a million, you know, licenses being violated. It's just a question of how active these artists are in enforcing their intellectual property.
Yeah, it's like we talked about with the NCAA, how they, I mean, they have attorneys out there that solely search the internet all day long and search the areas to try and find people that are violating the merchandising agreement, too.
So, Sam, when you're selling your Lil Jon paraphernalia downstairs on Michigan Avenue, watch out.
He's turned down for what?
Yes.
Water bottles?
Flask. Binoculars. The binocular flasks. I used to have a pair of those. Let's close out with Wiz Khalifa, who is suing his former label and his manager. The hip-hop artist has filed a lawsuit against Benji Greenberg and his first record label, Rostrum Records, claiming that they took advantage of a young up-and-coming rapper from Philadelphia and made a bunch of unknown revenue that he did not know about.
Yeah, something we see all the time in the entertainment industry is artists who sign these what are called 360 deals early on. He signed it when he was 16 years old. A 360 deal gives basically the label and the management a percentage of everything that the artist does. And Wiz is arguing that that should be thrown out. He's trying to argue that the seven-year rule should apply, meaning that workers can't be held to personal services contracts for more than 7 years after service begins. So we will continue to monitor all rap legal news here on Legal Face Off. What's our favorite Wiz Khalifa jam there, Sam?
Black and Yellow.
Mesmerized?
Mesmerized?
Yeah.
They did that one?
Yeah. Young and On His Grind, I think, is one of my favorite ones.
He did a song with Snoop Dogg. It was Young and Wild and Free.
Well, my
describes
favorite
this show quite a bit.
Yeah. Well, my favorite is exactly. The romantic ballad called We Dem Boys.
That about does it for Legal Face Off here on WGN Plus. For Rich and Jason, I am Sam. LFO Palooza coming up soon.
Coming up. Mark your calendar. I know you're waiting. Lots of surprise guests. Lots of good times going to happen at Legal Face Off.
Celebrating 2 years.
LFO Palooza.
2 years together?
Yeah, we're barely almost 2 years. But
I think the show is
counting
after the party. So maybe
yes,
we can recap.
Absolutely.
And we will see you in 2 weeks. For anything you may have missed, WGNplus.com. Search for Legal Face Off. We will see you in 2 weeks.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.